flip at the vertex.
Those numbers, like six to seven, is that from
You will
the
see.
calculator?
You will see. You will see. Just for orientation, I give the outline. Now I mentioned where the ideas come from. So the ideas, of course, there are classical papers about instantons from 70s. I didn't list those. Then there were around 1990 to 1993 big explosion of activity in instant-induced processes in electron weak theory, where of course they have a very good signature. They change baryon number, and Ringwald and Spinoza found that the cross section grows, and then many other people have argued that it grows and then decay, and even it's in its maximum there is this factor, which is 16 pi squared over g squared for a weak g, and that is what I would call dilutness parameter, which is 10 to minus 85 in electric theory. So forget about it, and all these people didn't even complete it, all these papers, and disappear for a while. But in QCD, as I told you, the analog of this factor is 10 minus 2. So it's still relatively suppressed. Actually, the factor itself, E minus this action, the action for a typical QCD instanton is of the order of 12. So you may think e to minus 12 is also so small that you can forget about it. But there is pre-exponent, et cetera, and in total it is of the order of 1%. So this is a smallness which goes with it in QCD. The papers which I was involved first was like 2 years ago here, that there were two groups, one with Dima Kharzeyev, one of the co-organizers who will come later, and the other is our group. Suddenly we realized that out of these formulas with instanton-induced processes, it has features which correspond to the classical Pomeron, the soft Pomeron, and it has a size, the instance has this small size, about third of a Fermi, and the Pomeron has similar size, and one can calculate from cross-section and find that that there is a correspondence. So that was how I was involved in it. I wouldn't speak about it, and that is, of course, not for nuclear collisions. This is for very high energy proton-proton or other collisions like that. The discussion of this, what happens at RIC, and the realization that if you produce this classical object in PP collisions, basically it goes into several gluons and quarks, and then confinement takes care of it, and it's supposed to be projected on some hadronic state. In vacuum, these gluons cannot fly far. However, if you produce it in this excited environment, the trick, the final state into which you produce all this stuff is quark gluon plasma. It has perturbative properties. It has gluons and quarks as quasiparticles with the finite masses. And these masses, as I will argue, are relatively low. So you can really produce all this stuff and use classical theory till the very end, or till nearly the very end, its screen itself, and know how much entropy you produce out of it. So that was important. The explosion of turning states, which we just solved a couple of months ago, both analytically and numerically, that was the main element of this talk. And now we're discussing this jet quenching. And I would say that there is alternative scenario put and of course, in reality, there is some combination of the two or something else happening from Larry McLaren and Raju Venugopalan, who describe it also by classical Young-Mills fields, this final state. But these classical Young-Mills fields come from colliding particles, and it's random. So it is like Gaussian random glass of color field which is produced. And in my case, I produce a small structures which explode into coherent shells. So the geometry of this are different, but they both use classical Young-Mills.
Well, when you get the
it's not a surprise since you're doing Young-Mills there.
No, of course not.
It sounds very different.
Yes, yeah. Pictures are very different. Oh. Right.
Will there be experiment? I mean, are you going to experiment? Is there an experimental prediction that will tell us who's more right?
Going ahead of myself, I will tell in principle. I hope so. But in principle, yeah, first of all, if you go to infinite high energy, and your saturation scale, so to say, is really high, you can forget about instantons.
Yeah.
But the trick, I think it's the other way around, but we will see. One generic idea I can sell right away, that if you have a kind of Gaussian random field, and you know roughly what energy you have, so you know what the amplitude of the field you have. And it has some standard, just a second.
Classical
field. So you collide two nuclei, and it excited a classical random chaotic field after two nuclei pass by there. And well, that's what this model is. I'm saying the normalization of that field is normalized to the excitation energy. And my normalization is also normalized to the same excitation energy. However, if I produce very coherent shell of strong field, I have a diluteness factor which allow my field to be stronger. And from point of view of jet quenching, for example, I got more kick because field is not distributed everywhere and things like that.
When you use the word random, do people actually know what ensemble you're taking a random?
No, they just speculate it's a glass-like.
They're both here next week, by the way.
Yes, you will hear these talks. Don't want to emphasize competitors.
I just got a request from the people who are not involved in this directly to hear a review of that glassy stuff.
Right. Which is, it's a good stuff. I'm just saying I'm a little. So roughly speaking, you might say they get the particles in Young-Mills field, etc., directly from partons, and I get it directly from materialization vacuum structure. So this is clearly both exist. Yes. And
dilution consistent with saturation. The saturation scale is of the order of the GMD or so.
Yeah, but the geometry of the objects is very different. So. No, you may say the scale is roughly the same, but the objects are different. So what exactly does GEV mean? It has different meaning, right, depending what objects are there. Okay, so now I go to a classical quantum mechanics on Young-Mills field, and here you see a very schematic picture of the familiar potential. Now, when I draw this picture, by the way, I haven't known how the real potential looked like, and I have drawn this picture for 20-something years, and now I know how the potential look like, and it look a little different, so you'll see. Anyway, this is 0, this is 1, and there are integer numbers for which Chern-Simons number can correspond to pure gauge field with a 0 field strength, and so there's a classical vacuum. The instant is a tunneling from here to there, or anti-instant is back, and it all corresponds to energy equals 0 because of duality condition, so kinetic energy is negative and potential is positive and the sum is 0. This is in Minkowski notation, there is I. So instanton is tunneling between classical vacuum, as everybody knows, and it disappears physically. It starts from nothing and then with nothing, etc. However, if you have a dynamical process so that during this tunneling, there is external force acting, and my colliding gluons and all kind of things going around, I treat as an external force. And I wouldn't specify that part of trajectory. If I would and calculate its action, I can calculate what's the probability of going from here to this green point will be, but I wouldn't do it. I will do it for some examples only. The point is, this trajectory goes in Euclid and then it goes into Minkowski. It crosses somewhere here, where total energy equals potential energy. Now, what is this point? This point is the point where momentum is 0. What is momentum? Momentum is in A not equals 0 gauge. It's a gluon electric field. So here, there is 0 electric field, and only magnetic object occurs. After that, the action no long action is real, and E to IS has modulus 1, which means no matter what happens later, it doesn't change the probability of what happens, right, as usual in quantum mechanics. So if you start here and solve classical equation of motion, you can tell what happens, but it doesn't change the probability. This is what I'm going to do. And what else would I want to say about it? As farther on is the top. Okay, so that's all what I wanted to say about this is just generic quantum mechanics. And there was a lot of work done in electroweak theory. There is some difference in pure gauge theory, and it was not somehow worked out for some reason. So I started thinking about what I called force tunneling or instant and anti-instant configuration. So instant is tunneling, anti-instant tunneling back. If you have them infinitely far away from each other in Euclidean, It's just tunneling and anti-tunneling. If you put some, try to measure something in between, there is nothing there, and no physical fields. Of course, you are in different topological classical vacuum. Now, if instant and anti-instant become closer to each other, it's more complicated what these configurations are. People, of course, they occur in the vacuum, and people studied what is the action of such configurations. If they are at very large distances, there are dipole forces, which David calculated with his collaborators. If they are closer to each other, the forces are not dipole, but more complicated, and people were arguing how to properly do it. The idea is, what complicated that is that, of course, instant and anti-instant configuration are not solution of Young-Mills equation. They're not minima. They populate the valley, and the valley goes from two separate instant and anti-instant to configuration when they're on top of each other and the field is zero. So this valley has some special conditional minima, and that was all kind of studies of that. I wouldn't go into that, but want to say that I just take these results and later on, but we'll argue a little bit differently. So I will look at instant and anti-instant configuration as a, not as an amplitude which occurs in vacuum, just kind of failed tunneling that you tunnel and tunnel back, but really as a probability, not amplitude, that you go from one of the classical vacuum into some physical state. And this is modulus squared. So there would be two parts in that amplitude, one part complex conjugate of another, and there would be production of something. So you will see that I will produce some object in the middle, which in the middle of instant and anti-instant. And because d mu, g mu, nu is not zero, I will consider, call it external current. So
the external current is representing the somehow the fact that it's a two-part partial state is in there.
Or many partons falling onto it. So there is some external force which rises a system from zero energy to some intermediate energy.
Right, so the overlap problem, I think of that Jx as acting to the left.
It, right.
It turns the vacuum.
The reason why I emphasize this formula is that if, in principle, we can do this conditional minima, but it is pretty complicated. I will only use the so-called ansatzes, which means you invent a formula for a mu and you calculate this. After you calculate this, you know what current is needed for this process.
The overlap problem would turn into a smallness of this peak.
Right. Yes. But I wouldn't claim that my study here would be realistic. I will use some examples of such tunneling paths. The reason I'm doing it, I want to understand what the states are which I excite. Now,
so if you're turning around, you're looking for
The intermediate state. No, I know. Just a second. You will see in the next transparency. Let me first say what is the simplest ansatz? You can write instanton plus anti-instanton in singular gauge, and this is called as a sum ansatz. Now, this sum ansatz has many bad features. One of them is that if you write in a singular gauge has a singularity at x equals zero. But if you calculate g mu nu squared, like gauge invariant quantity, it does not have singularity because everything cancels. Now, if you write sum of the instanton and anti-instanton both in singular gauge, what happens is that the leading singularity cancels, but the next one do not. So fields are still singular, which is not good, but the action is finite. So you can live with it, but it has other bad features for my purposes, so it wouldn't work. But a very simple modification of that, sorry?
What are the bad features?
You will see. The bad features is that this set of configuration, yes, it's still a gauge singularity. Yes, but it doesn't do tunneling. It doesn't do tunneling in my direction I want. Yes, so it wouldn't be good for my purposes. No, it's not a problem of gauge invariance. That is not really a serious problem. It doesn't do what I want. That is a problem. And I invented some ratio ansatz, which is like a formula. Now y1 and y2 are distances from centers to the observation point x, where the field is measured. So if one of these y's is infinite, you can drop this term and that is the usual instanton. But then the field is finite, for example. And even if you get two points closer and closer to each other, the action is not divergent and not become very big. So it looked like a nice formula. So this is my simplest example. And it has a very good feature that if you change t to minus t, t is a time, so this is time direction, and I can take centers to be at the origin in space. This also, and that is plus t over 2 capital T, and this is minus t over 2 capital T is a time distance between the centers. So the whole thing is symmetric against the plane in the middle, and that already tell you that a naught, for example, is zero on that plane. And if you that will be true of the sum also, but this sum has other problems.
And this thing is a pure gauge when instanton and anti-instanton get on top of each other, or not?
No. It's a finite configuration,
oh.
And that already tell you that it does not do all the way well.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Way.
But I will show you on the next transparency that there was an ansatz invented which actually does it, which is very complicated, although.
Oh, I see.
Okay, but right now, so I have this t to minus t symmetry with this simple ansatz, and so I have, in the whole plane here, I don't have electric field. So if I really plot this, so this is my geometry, which I just explained, and this is e squared, b squared, and e dot b. This is gauge invariant quantities along this line. So you see two maxima. This is instant and anti-instant. You can, if you look here with some magnification, you see that e squared go for zero, e dot b go for zero, and b squared does not, which means that this plane can be interpreted as a kind of a cut, unitarity cut. You really produce some physical object here in the middle, which has this is my turning state. It has zero electric field and it has no zero magnetic field, so it has a structure, and this object is actually produced. And then the other one is just conjugate amplitude.
Now, if you do the same thing for this,
it also looks similar, but now what I want to do next, I vary my t from infinity to zero, and I can calculate energy. Usually we calculated before just the action. Now I calculate the energy on this plane, and I calculate Chern-Simons number on this plane, and if I plot energy versus Chern-Simons number, I get my potential, V over N Chern-Simons, and I know what states are sitting on the potential. Okay? And I can do it for this ansatz very easily.
So the Chern-Simons goes from 0 then to 1,
right,
to some continuous...
Well, then it repeats periodically.
Oh, okay.
So the thing is that I can calculate it. Now, if I omit the details, I show you this. So this is the energy versus Chern-Simons number. Fortunately, you can't see very well here. It has this behavior. And
what's the vertical axis? I can't
stand. This is E times R. Why it is
okay.
Times R? R is the mean square radius of this object.
Okay.
The classical Lang-Mills is scale invariant. So you always can minimize energy by making larger object. That was one of the problems why people never understood how to deal with this problem. If I can take mean square radius R, now, if object is twice larger in size, E is twice less, and R is twice larger, this combination does not change on the scale transformation. And so this is kind of scale invariant potential. And it goes like this, and with the sum ansatz, it ends somewhere. So when T equals zero, which means for this ansatz, instant is on top of each other, it has finite energy and finite Chern-Simons number. Unfortunately, this Chern-Simons number is not one or one half. It's only a quarter. So it's a set of configuration which is not enough for me to go from one valley to another. It's a set of configuration which start at the beginning of the path and then it's M disappear. Now, okay, so finally, to make it cut, so Alyosha Jung invented the ansatz, which is too complicated to be written here, which was obtained, which is also instanton plus anti-instanton in some singular way, but you put it in some conformal way, instanton inside the anti-instanton, and then do conformal transformation so that you have instant and anti-instant. The formula has several terms which are called correction terms. So it looks like instant plus anti-instant plus correction term. And it looks awful, and it doesn't have T to minus T symmetry. Nevertheless, if you calculate in the plane what is the electric field, it's also zero. And so if I calculate for the Jungansatz, I get all this. And it's nearly exactly symmetric around 1/2, and it goes to finite magnitude. And remember, this is 29, and that would be explained on next transparency. So Jungansatz completely did it. So what it means is
you
that...
You made some assumption of the size of the instanton?
No, because this is energy times R. It's streamline equation is that equation which Jung proposed to solve. That will be the Jungansatz is approximate solution to streamline equation. Streamline equation is a Young-Mills equation saying that it is a minimum in all directions except for the direction of the mode along the valley.
That's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it. Verbaschot solved it numerically. Jung did not solve it numerically. He wrote a very complicated formula, and his formula, when we put capital T equals zero, it's still a complicated, nasty formula. When we calculate it, Jacques calculate numerically the action for this case, and it turned out to be zero. So it's a complicated field, which is pure gauge. And therefore this formula actually does the travel all the way, and when they're on top of each other completely, you get zero again.
So all of this approximation respects gauge invariance and so on?
Yes, they do. No. They do. This Jungansatz is up to accuracy like 3%. You can see that this line which I get is not symmetric around 1/2, but it's very close to it, to being symmetric. And you also see that there is some spread here.
So the streamline equation is what you is the correct way to define
right.
Right. Cell
right. Right. And Jung invented a formula which up to a couple percent just solve it.
So it's approximate, I think.
It's approximate.
It's pure gauge.
No, it's pure gauge here. Oh, okay. When they top, fall on each other, it's pure gauge, and in the middle, so it solved the problem. Okay. It describes this potential with very high accuracy, and I know each state what I'm producing. This is what I did.
Confused. The streamline equation, do I think of that as some kind of gauge invariant approximation? No, what is it?
You have an instant, you have an event. That's not a solution.
Right, not a solution. Right.
There is a collect. So when you do a path integral, right, you have a, if you were to put a constraint that fixes the collective coordinate, otherwise, yeah, if they didn't interact, right. For instance, there's a collective mode in response to the translational mode.
Yeah.
Those collective modes, you fix, you find the setup point, you integrate it, collective mode, nothing depends on this.
Oh, I see. Again,
here's something that depends on it.
Okay.
However, you can fix, there are lots of constraints you can fix. Mm-hmm. So think about, you're doing a Euclidean path integral. You have something which is sort of like a minimum of the action. Except there's a valley.
Yeah.
And you bring them together, you lower the action, you get to zero after all the valley. Mm-hmm. You fix that degree of freedom. But you want to fix it in such a way that orthogonal to that, you have a minimum. So you want to go along the side.
Yes, right. So you add Lagrange multiplier, which will fix you along this line, etc. Right.
And that's the way to do it.
But
I don't understand. Is that what you're going to work with?
The fact that it's linear. I mean, so if you make this periodic.
Yes, it is. It is actually linear here.
But if you make it periodic, you go.
Yeah, then it repeats like this.
Should I be worried about the fact that it's then if I go from 1 minus epsilon to 1 plus epsilon, there's a discontinuity of
modulus.
Yeah.
There is, but I don't know what's wrong with it. This is the potential. Yes, and this is how it looks like.
And what parameter can I change to change this type?
No, it's just number. It's 3 pi squared, actually, as you will see on next transparency. It's just property of this potential.
This is not the problem. This is one instant, one anti-instant, not what you do if you have instant, anti-instant, which is a much more complicated problem.
No, it's just how a potential look like, and I know. And I know what each point of it has a structure. This is just energy. It's a magnetic field hedgehog type a cluster which has certain energy and certain size and structure. and it has, you know, sit on that curve. The same objects we obtain by minimization. Now, why people haven't done it before?
The one half is, the thing up in the middle there is one half?
Yes, the middle was a sphaleron, yes. Now, in electroweak theory, the main difference was there was a scale and people were not worried about this R. Now we have to worry. So I determined, I defined, for example, if you look for minimum potential energy, there is no minimum. If you fix the value of Chern-Simons number, and you fix the given root mean square size, which is defined this way, and you write this is Young-Mills magnetic energy, static, plus 1 over rho squared is Lagrange multiplier with this R squared, this is this thing here, plus kappa times Chern-Simons number, and then you minimize, and after you minimize, so you have Young-Mills equation from variation of this, plus two terms proportional to these multipliers, and you can solve it. And then we have constraint minima, and this constraint minima has B squared, has that simple shape, it just, unlike electroweak sphaleron, it's simple analytic, and B squared has this shape. See, this is R squared plus rho squared to the 4. It's localized ball. Its total energy is this. 3 pi squared agrees very well with the previous formula. Of course, everything agrees. Kappa is a parameter. It's this kappa. It's Lagrange multiplier to Chern-Simons number. If I eliminate from these two formulas the kappa, I get E of N Chern-Simons, and that is the potential. This is what was plotted. So I have played with these ansatzes, but now I can do without, and the same thing happens. So kappa equals 0 correspond to the top, that's a sphaleron. And if you put rho, the size of this object is rho. And we don't know rho. Some quantum effect should tell us what rho is. If you take rho, the size of the vacuum instanton, and calculate what the energy, the energy is something like 2.7 GeV. So this sphaleron is a magnetic ball with 2.7 GeV energy. And it sits in SU2 and wants to explode. Right, and partons, and he's going to explode. Now explosion. Explosion, we saw it recently in two ways. So I have a student and a postdoc, Greg Carter. So I first gave to Greg to calculate it numerically because it's certainly going to work. And the student look at it analytically and both solve it. And the results agree. So I'm very confident that the thing worked. But just solving classical Young-Mills, after all, with the initial condition, which are these balls, which were described just now. So this is four components of A mu. Which can be written in terms of four functions, A, B, C, D. Now, Witten invented a very nice form. They're all functions of R and T, they're spherical. And these are, of course, just some tensors. This one is longitudinal. So C, for example, can be eliminated by gauge transformation, but the others are transverse. What Witten...
No.
That was two balls in four dimensions. And my three-dimensional object, which I produce, is a small time, a time equals zero plane, three-dimensional plane in the middle.
It's halfway between the two.
Right. This time equals zero plane is where I go from Euclid to Minkowski.
Right.
After that, I have Minkowski evolution, and then I have T and R. Okay? At T equals zero, I have this ball. Now, this is the action which Witten wrote. The nice thing about this theory is that he rewrite it as two components of field phi, which is a complex Higgs field, and two components of A mu, which is A naught and A1. And unfortunately, they are in some curve manifold, but the gauge freedom of Young-Mills and the gauge freedom of this model map naturally, so it's very nice. And you can write equation of motion in this form, or you can write equation of motion in the original form. The point is that the time, of course, now it's time and R dependent equation with particular initial conditions.
Yeah,
Yeah, I restrict to my, but my initial condition is spherically symmetric, so it's going to be, unless there is instability or who knows what. It's not a supernova.
No, well, what produces the stuff that isn't radially symmetric?
Right. What produces, that's correct. Right. The original thing which produced that stuff, my hammer which I hit it, presumably was not symmetric, but it's so, not at all, but.
Presumably it was axial symmetric at best.
Not even maybe axial symmetric locally around the impact parameter, but this is what the direction of this topological coordinate. Okay, anyway, we solve radial symmetric.
Okay, maybe it did. I mean,
yes.
It's obviously
the first step. It's obviously the first step.
It doesn't logically make sense to me, and the argument that point,
well, the instanton is symmetric, and the instant field is much. Although the incoming stuff, the hammer, is not symmetric,
yeah.
The instant is, and the amplitude of the field of the instant is very.
Not only is energy conserved, momentum is conserved.
Correct. Yeah.
So, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Because if you really started with a hammer that's going to take you to this.
But you can start with a zero momentum initial state. Energy
momentum
reduction. There's
an axis. Come on.
So we can do
an S-wave. Yeah, in some sense, this is the first.
No, but I mean, I'm still worried about. I mean, this is all part of his. He's escaping by not bothering to calculate the probability for the tunnel. Right.
He's assuming all these partons, which have enormous momentum along the beam.
Yeah.
Right.
They're all in the vacuum and.
Making it spherically symmetric.
Why spherically symmetric? They have momentum, each one of them.
Well, but I would say, why is the probability not small? I mean, why is there not this, as Jan originally said, this is all part of the bad overlap. Right.
No, he can calculate the probability. He's not going to get it small.
Okay, anyway.
Get something, but why is it spherically symmetric?
No, it would not probably be spherically symmetric, but it only, if you calculate it very naively, yes, namely that there is an instanton and incoming gluon comes and we write a vertex, et cetera, et cetera, in a standard way, which, by the way, from that paper. The instant is spherically symmetric and it absorbs it in a spherical symmetric way. Yes?
What happens
in the momentum carrier as well? Well, it, of course, transfers to this. So if there are many of them from different direction and they kind of compensate each other, it. There must be a quantum correction.
What frame are we doing with that? I mean, the hammer is not.
Well, of course. Well, okay. In the calculation where we calculated the amplitude, we have a formula, and the formula, of course, does conserve the energy and momentum, and it does.
With a zero momentum.
Right, and it does with because there is d four z over instant position, and the formula conserve energy and momentum. What happens is that there is a formula with a total.
Like you're just putting in energy.
Yeah, because I'm in the rest frame of. But you say, what is the rest frame of the instanton? There is no such thing. But there is a rest frame of a sphaleron, which is produced. It's the object. Yes, I can sit in that object.
Yeah. You're in the center frame of the original.
The question is, are right. All these sphalerons.
Not the original two partons. The original two partons fly by. They have. Weizsäcker-Williams, remember there were two guys who are passing by, they emit two T-channel gluons, the Weizsäcker-Williams fields, which are then absorbed.
Are all these sphalerons you produce in the same rest frame?
No, they are distributed in rapidity, in all rapidities from zero, and that, by the way, what in this Pomeroy calculation give a rising cross-section. Which
so this calculation be done in the rest frame of one of the partons that initiates this?
Yeah, the diagram was like this, that there are Weizsäcker-Williams fields, and the rapidity of this object is everywhere between rapidity of this and that. And that gives me log of x,
right,
which...
And that's the rapidity of the sphaleron.
And that's rapidity of a sphaleron,
so this
finally.
Down the rest frame of the sphaleron.
Yes, you might say the rest frame of sphaleron, yes, that this object is produced and then explodes.
It isn't the lab.
No, it isn't the lab. It's completely undetermined, and it sits in all frames. And when I say how many of these objects are produced, by the way, that would be per unit rapidity in the whole interval of 10 units of rapidity of Rigg. Okay, anyway, so we solve it. It's a little bit late. This is how it looks like. The gauge dependent, the configurations, of course, are complicated, but if you plot what I plot here, epsilon of R is energy density, it's gauge invariant quantity, this is zero. This is initials farther on. If you look very well, there is something R squared here. And the R squared is needed because this is the integral which is going to be conserved. That would be total energy. And these things are how it looked like at different time moments.
Configuration at t equals zero, that distance is just your one-third term?
Yes. This is in some units on the lattice, numerical lattice. Forget it. And so this is where it was at the beginning, and that at large time, 100 in the original steps, it looks like this, and then it simply expands. So it expands into spherical shell very quickly. And the field is transverse here, and because when time increases, this R squared increases, the field becomes weak, and finally it becomes a weak gluon field, non-linear, sorry, linear, linear gluon fields. So this object really goes into class in the gluons classically. Sorry? With the speed of light. And the reason why it's so explosive compared to electroweak case, we also did electroweak case and people did before us. In electroweak case, you have W's and Z's who are produced about 50 of them, but they are all massive, and the energies are of the order of mass. So electroweak spheron is not that explosive as this stuff, because this is considered to be massless. Now, another very interesting thing is which we found is that this is a Chern-Simons number density, which is
I think of that as sort of exploding glue balls, and then I have to worry about the fact that the glue ball mass is actually rather large.
That's my next transparency. Wait. That's exactly my next transparency. Right now, it's a classical solution. The point is...
What's the reason that you have a shell?
Because they all move at the speed of light, what else can they do? And the size, the thickness of the shell is still my 0.3 Fermi of the original object. It's very quickly making into, it could have, the field configuration itself, by the way, has a complicated, the postdoc, Greg Carter, who did it, was mailing me saying, this Fermion don't want to explode, he said. Yes, and after I plotted this, it became clear all this stuff he had behind was pure gauge.
Yeah.
And so it does explode. So returning to Chern-Simons number, if you do exactly as Fermion, it has exactly zero energy state with three-dimensional zero mode, which means there is a Dirac particle captured in that object, and its kinetic energy is exactly compensated by mu dot b term. So it's zero energy state. Now, whether it's Dirac told us that if you have positive energy states, it's empty, negative energy state, it's occupied. If it is exactly E equals zero state, you don't really know what to do. But we thought, okay, this is accelerator, there is expansion, there is electric field, it will pump this particle either to positive or to negative energy, and this quarks would be either produced or not. What happened for this Fermion is the Chern-Simons number during the explosion doesn't change. It carries together with the wave. And that is extremely funny because at the very end, you get my several gluons. Each gluon do not have a Chern-Simons number. But together, they still have. And this is the same problem people actually have. We look in the literature on electroweak theory, and it turned out many honorable people wrote papers in the 80s and 90s about this phenomenon, nobody suggested what the answer is. It also looked like this, that the Fermion explodes, and not Fermion, any state with arbitrary Chern-Simons number, and it carries to large time absolutely arbitrary Chern-Simons number with it. And that is a baryon number. So you have 50 W's and Z's flying away, each of them has no baryon number. Together they're in coherent state entangled and have 0.335 of a baryon. And how experimentalists is going to decide what will happen with it, I don't know. Here it's very simple because it will meet some matter on the way, and that will scatter it either into positive or negative, and with probability 1/2. So that will match. Now the question which Krishna asked, and that is very important. Now I go into our trick. How much time I have?
10-15 minutes.
Well, then I will go very quickly. So this is about one reason why Rick is.
You didn't ask me what frame.
Right, I can compress it, and then it decompress. One more reason why Rick is so special. Rick, this
you
is temporary.
Why you can use classical?
Yes, 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 that I'm going to say. This is a cutoff of perturbative QCD. So at zero temperature, we are in vacuum. We don't know really what the cutoff is because there is a confinement. Let me assign, for lack of time, 1 GeV is a cutoff and say this is roughly half mass of a glue ball or something in the vacuum. But in QGP, we know from perturbation theory that at high temperature there is this formula, so it grows with T, at Kerguelen plasma. What is important here is that if you look at the lattice data on thermodynamics, for example, pressure, there couldn't be pressure if there are no gluons flying around and quarks. And they wouldn't fly around at this temperature if they don't have, if the cutoff is very high. So, and also there are data on the biomass. So there are people who fitted lattice data with a simple model where there is effective gluon mass. This is my effective gluon mass. And in this region of temperatures, which actually happen at Rick, somewhere here up to 3 TC, it's relatively stable, and you might say that rise with T and decrease of G compensate each other or whatever, and they stay at about 400 MeV. This is a number to remember. So, and when I expand my spectrum of my outgoing classical Lang Mills, so this is a cutoff on a glue. And I should add to classical Lang Mills action a term which is a plasma term, which is this effective action in the plasma, which some people derived. In first approximation, just P mu nu, polarization tensor, proportional to T squared. And this is where my description will fail. And now, that's the biomass, or the biomass, yes. And this is my spectrum, which I can calculate for my standard sphaleron. And there is a formula, and there is a spectrum. And this is where this mass is. The mass is, I said, 400 MeV. The typical energy is of the order of 0.7, 700 MeV. So what I'm telling is I start where my non-perturbative phenomenon already show up, and I claim it show up as a peak with invariant mass around 3 GeV already, 3 GeV. Then I go with this classical description and end up in Kerguelen plasma. And when I end in Kerguelen plasma, I am above the cutoff, so I can use it, and I produce all of these guys, five or six of them, and I'm consistent.
So 5 or 6 comes from dividing 3 GeV by this?
More or less, by dividing by this average field. So I started in vacuum with rather high scale for non-perturbative physics, and then I happened to be above the cutoff, so I was consistent with perturbative QC cutoff.
David's question about classicalness, I mean, for it to be classical, you need many quanta per mode.
Right. So I have about the in some sense the typical instanton, as I said, the action was 12. That is roughly the number of quanta. This is how quanta this instanton are. But this object is like 1/2, and they indeed give 6. So they end up in 6 quanta. Well, it's number much larger than 1, I claim, and I use classical theory for that reason. Anyway, I move very, very quickly about Rick, because I have to say something about this. Now, about puzzles. I really have to explain one thing, if at all, what is V2, for those who don't know, because that was a very important a year ago. V2 described the so-called azimuthal asymmetry. When you collide two nuclei, this is one nuclei, this is another nuclei in a frame, in a plane which is impact parameter plane, X and Y.
Right, so
one of them goes from here, another from another room, and this is where they overlap. So all my exciting matter has this shape. And then many things may happen. If I start from this one, which is perturbative QCD type, that the particles just collide and scatter and materialize, and they don't know any other particle. This is what our PQCD friends were telling us. There would be no collectivity. It doesn't matter which direction is the almond. They will be azimuthally, spherically symmetric and nothing will happen. On the other hand, if we have coagulant plasma, we will get a bank, and a bank will be in this direction much more than in this direction, because this is where the gradient of the pressure is. So while looking at this quantity, which is called V2, it's a harmonic, second harmonic in this plane, we can distinguish collective and very non-collective models or some other models. And the very first measurement of this was this V2, which happened to be very big. And not only it was very big, but it was in perfect agreement with Hydra. So this is SPS, this is CERN, this is Hydra, this is data. They are not in very good agreement, except here. Hydra is hydrodynamics with equation of state of coagulant plasma. Very straightforward, simplistic description. Sorry?
Free quarks.
Well, not really free quarks. It's a parameterization of free of data in some sense. It is free quarks at high temperature, but it has a phase transition in which there is a mixed phase. It has very soft. No. He gave us all.
You take the
equations. You know, Hydra equations I got from Euler and equation of state from this guy, so I don't have any parameters to worry. And the final result, etc., is also done nicely, and it doesn't have. So here is the prediction and the data. This is central collision. This is very peripheral collision. So if you see very, very peripheral collision when this nuclei nearly touch each other, the data are still as high as a Hydra. This is amazing. So even when you produce very thin, elongated object, it expands as Hydra tells. And then there are many, many other figures like this, which I wouldn't show. There is also radial explosion, which I also wouldn't show. What I want to show is this one, because it relates to jet quenching. This is real puzzling thing. Now, what is plotted is the same V2, as I explained to you. It's a magnitude of the harmonic. The different colors correspond to different impact parameter range. This is more central. This is less central. Of course, if you are at impact parameter zero, this effect doesn't exist. So it goes to zero when this blue is small. What is important, so this Hydra description describes this. And then you go to larger PT. And larger PT, the belief of many was that around 2 GeV, you go into perturbative QCD, and you go to perturbative QCD, everything comes from jets. If everything comes from jets, and you can calculate how many jets there are, etc., you expect that these curves will fall. Because at large PT, it doesn't matter which direction you go, you get the same thing. And it doesn't. Now, this magnitude can be compared to some geometrical model that I worked out, which I won't even tell you what it is about. But these green lines are, if you have a geometric model and you have infinite absorption, you emit it from a surface of this almond, and this is a maximal, this is V with a star, is a maximal value of V2. So this green corresponds to the maximal value of this, and the data are about maximal value. So model with geometric absorption in that object cannot describe this data because the object is not deformed strongly enough to accommodate this change. To explain how what this means is the following. This is a formula. The distribution in phi plane is 1 plus 2v2 cos 2 phi. Now, when v2 is this, 20%, it is plus and minus 0.4. So the ratio in x direction and y direction of particles observed is 2 to 1. Now, if you and this is at large transverse momentum. This is a pion on other hadron with 6 GeV momentum, which presumably come from 10 GeV jet. So this 10 GeV jet remarkably knows about direction of the almond, yes, which means they absorb like hell, yes. With this, so this jet quenching is very robust. This is. I don't.
The only way that that could be is that it started out as a 20 GeV jet and it discovered about the almond by.
No, that there are some other things. There are collective flow effects, etc., etc. Now I omit all my stuff, and basically say that from PP collisions and some rising cross section, etc., we get upper limit on how many of these objects we produce, and that is roughly 80 per unit rapidity. If I multiplied by 6. This is my quarks and gluons coming out. I get about 500, and that is roughly half of the entropy of the system.
Wait, where did this estimate of how many of these things per unit rapidity?
From a previous transparency, I'll tell you later. We worked it out.
Wait, but it came from phenomenology? Or from?
Yes, from phenomenology. And some estimates, but phenomenology, yeah. This is, if we fit it from the statement that if production of this object describe rising cross-section in PP, that it's not mini jets, but it explains the Pomeron. Then we fix our parameters, and then we collide the nuclei and ask how many.
So wait, and so then what multiplicity does that correspond to?
Maybe I should show you one thing. If you ignore the table, just this number. But if you collide two quarks and you produce this phaleron, what is the cross-section? The cross-section is about 10 minus 3 Fermi squared.
So this is?
This is some small cross-section proportional to this instant diluteness and some others. It's a small effect. But in heavy ion collisions, there are so many part-on-part-on collisions, you multiply all the numbers in the geometry, you get 80 per unit rapidity. And you multiply each of them by 6, you get about significant portion of total entropy. So this is one take on the entropy, that you can produce enough entropy. And the last thing which I want to say is, maybe I skip this, and I ask forgiveness from you guys, because that was about jet quenching, but I do not do it, and just want to show this. This is these two diagrams is Bremsstrahlung in QED. These three diagrams in Bremsstrahlung in QCD. And there are formulas for that, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we want to solve a problem when you have a thin shell with electric and magnetic field falling and a jet going through it. So it gets a kick, and there are three diagrams, radiation after, radiation before. Now the gluon is curved by a field, but it's still Bremsstrahlung. And here is a more interesting phenomenon, which you call QCD cyclotron radiation. It's when you produce a quark and gluon, and they both curve in magnetic field in different direction with different radii. Now, accidentally, I wrote a paper in 75 with Kriplovich about gravitational radiation. So there are three problems. If you look at them in perspective, that's very nice, and I want to finish with this. So this is a magnetic field, a little magnet standing, and a particle flies by, and we open Jackson and read how it radiates. And if you don't want classical radiation, then we have to open another book about cyclotron radiation with a quantum. And when we did it, by the way, we found that it's a very messy subject. And there were only correction to classical. First correction derived by Schwinger, and then 20 years later, Schwinger give another derivation of that formula, of that correction, but the complete formulas are not really available. Anyway, so we know it curves by some piece of arc, and the photons radiated in all angles between this direction and that direction, and we have the formulas. Because photons go straight and electron curves, that's the reason why we have synchrotron radiation, everybody knows. This is a problem, and you have also electron going in circle but around a black hole. If electrons circle a black hole, in the gravitational field the photon also circle. So the question was in this paper, what would be the radiation? And the radiation happened to be reduced, the intensity, by factor gamma squared. And what is also interesting here, there is very small radiation length, 1/γ of that sector, from which radiation in given direction is done. In this problem, the whole radiation in any given direction is given from a whole circle. So this is an example when they both curve the same way. In QCD, you have a quark curving one direction and gluons curving in other directions. And they're also curving according to momentum. So I call it rainbow squared. They're analyzed by magnetic field according to their momenta and according to their color.
some gluons will go one way and some will go the other.
Some gluons go the other way, and they also, the radius of their curvature is of course inversely proportional to their radius, to their momentum. So kind of Newtonian prism analyzed by momentum.
They're curving, they're also bench-bound.
Right. Yeah, so I kind of solve it in classical approximation, and Ismail Zahed is now putting Schwinger formula on all these propagators. Well, there are many problems. It's a very interesting problem. Ismail claimed he will solve a complete QCD cyclotron radiation in a month. Okay. Well, it's a radiation, etc., etc. So. This is a byproduct, but we hope that will help somewhat.
Wait, so what's the context of this is you have one of these?
The idea is that.
What happens when these shells run into each other?
Well, after the shells run into each other, you get quarklion plasma. They become destroyed and the pill become weak, etc. They become.
Oh, you're saying they're quenching the.
Before. So during the first Fermi LHC, it passes through the shell, and there is one basically big kick.
Yeah.
The kick is about a GeV.
How is this shell defined in the gauge invariant?
It is defined. We have, no, of course, we can do gauge transformation, but we have complete solution. We have solution as a function of R and T. In some gauge, but we can do any gauge transformation which preserves it.
His energy density was localized on a shell.
Right.
No, I understand that.
It's,
but
you know.
I just don't understand the context of doing this in the gauge invariant.
No problem. No.
Yeah, I mean, how can we define that
it's
b squared?
Of the problem.
Yeah, how can we define b gauge invariant?
B squared is gauge invariant.
Sure.
E squared and b squared, yeah, okay. Of course, they are defined in particular gauge, but what
but
is bad about it?
About
we know how to do gauge transformations and.
The background, when you're solving for the radiation.
Yeah, when I call QCD. QCD cyclotron radiation, I meant in constant homogeneous magnetic field. Now we have a shell which has electric and magnetic and it has a kick. The reason, the only difference what people normally do is that there is a kick from a Coulomb force. Now if a jet goes very close to a parton, it has a kick. But that has a small cross section. So therefore, the scattering is supposed to be dominated in a normal quarklion plasma by a sum of many weak kicks. And then Landau-Pomeranchuk effect comes in and that suppresses it, etc. And the problem becomes interesting and complicated, etc., etc. Here is another. Now, this object is huge. It's a sphere. There is very high probability to hit it. For a jet, it's a form which fill the whole space at some moment. So I hope that will be very important. Okay, I'm done. This is my conclusions. Once again, what I said to you is that if there are instantons in the vacuum and you whack it with a hammer, each of them is going to leave a remnant, some little piece of ash, which in first approximation I treat as spherically symmetric. And each of these objects is, so instants are killed, by the way. After that, you create this volume with quarklion plasma, high temperature instants are suppressed, no more instantons. This is the last remnants of the last instantons and the time when you hit it. And they explode like this and hopefully produce a lot of entropy due to this interplay of parameters and the jet quenching. Now, well, all of the details should be worked out. Okay. And that is the beginning of the workshop, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I have two questions. Can you put in that transparency?
All the details will be worked out in the next 3 months.
Yeah, my first question, isn't there an author missing here?
Where? which line?
In the green pen.
This one? Well, yeah, there was Gross-Pisarsky Jaffe Review of Modern Physics, which had it. There was a small. They were both your students, right?
Uh-huh.
So in the PhD, there was a physics letter where these two people wrote this. So I, you know, I have a principle not to mention reviews, but mention the authors. Yes. But they were your students anyway, right?
A usual feature of the formation of the QGP is a research to be formed, I mean, in central collisions.
Right.
At mid rapidity.
Well, at all rapidity in some interval, right?
It's a question. I haven't asked the question.
Yeah, this is rapidity.
Now, in your picture, in a sense, you create QGP in all rapidity intervals from, say, minus 5 to 5, at least.
Kind of, yes. But it is actually produced like this. There is a, there is something like a relatively flat region there. There is no such thing as central mass frame. Yes, we really cannot know the central mass frame.
But these expressions occur in the whole interval of rapidity, not just at mid rapidity.
Strictly speaking, it happened to be completely flat when I used the spectrum of Weizsäcker-Wilhelm field that in my diagram here, I say for this omega, if I write the omega over omega like Weizsäcker-Wilhelm's, I get it flat and I get this logarithm. Right? In fact, this is a structure function, and this is a structure function of a nuclei and another nuclei. And the question is, what is the structure function? I can write it also dx over x and put alpha here, right? Now, depending on what is a q squared, this alpha is different.
That's
and if q squared is large, this alpha is relatively large, and therefore it does not have this shape. It will have a shape like this. However, if q squared is about 1 GeV or 2 GeV, this terrible rise with Hera found is not seen, and so alpha is about 1, you might say. Not 1.5. So q squared about 1 GeV, it's not such a bad approximation.
Let's assume saturation in a sense.
Well, this, the I don't know. That is just Weizsäcker-Wilhelm's formula. So if you literally do this diagram, you get this. The reason why you get more is that, of course, it's dressed, and there is evolution, and so in principle, if we will do BFKL, etc., we will get another power, and then a little different shape. But we are not that sophisticated yet.
Well, if you go up to, you know, 6 GeV PT or something like that,
yes.
Then if those 6 GeV protons are coming from jets, they're sort of the final state will be at those IPTs will be jetty. There'll be
right. People looked at that, and
it seems not to be very jetty. Right?
No, people looked at it, and particularly in Phoenix, they looked at it. If you look at it, interestingly enough, that the same methods at SPS, which is lower energy and much less perturbative QCD, SPS is in center of mass 10 plus 10 GeV. So you would say it's not very high energy, etc. If you have this direction of a jet, this elliptic flow will mean kind of quadrupole formula like this. If there is a jet, it's supposed to be higher here and somewhat reduced here, some other shape. And that shape was seen at SPS, but it was not seen at RIC. Another very, very important thing in this whole game, the crucial element was actually found recently. And next week we'll hear from star people, etc. The crucial element is the following. When you look at this very large asymmetries, etc., the crucial is how many pions there are and how many nucleons or lambdas, mesons versus baryons. Why is that? Because jet fragmentation does not produce baryons. It mostly produces mesons. Now, what I have shown, this V2, that was all charged particles. And the question is, it's all charged particles. The question is, somewhere above 2G, below approximately 2 GeV, all charged particles is the same as pions. Around here, they become 50-50 due to this some hydro effect. And whether these particles are baryons or pions is unknown.
They are going to tell us?
Yes, they're going to tell us, but wait a second. So jets do not produce baryons. Hydra produce high PT baryons very easily. This is flow, and heavy particles involved in the flow
have more momentum.
So this is this phenomenon that if you take a little piece of paper and throw it in the river, you get momentum m times v. So if m is larger and larger, you get larger momentum, and that will show here. And the question is, what are these particles, protons and pions? The resolution of all detectors cannot answer. It only works here, the time of light and other thing. So they couldn't figure out how to do it. And recently they did, they look at lambdas. It turns out there are as many lambdas as nucleons, and lambdas which make this V can be identifiable at any momentum. And the preliminary data are that lambdas who behave like this, they actually cross above. They produce even larger effect. So,
which means that
this constancy is presumably interplay between rising baryons and falling mesons. Mesons come from jets, and baryons do not come from jets. And so it's supposed to be clarified.
Wait, and you think you can just from hydrodynamic flow, you can get a 5 GeV baryon?
Yes, that was amazing. But the spectra themselves and this phenomena.
That's a baryon with a gamma of 5, right?
That's right.
So that's.
And the probability to have this baryon is 10 to minus 6 or something like this. So you might think.
We're talking about velocities of around half the speed of light. So
that's right.
How can you get a gamma of 5?
Very good question. And it is either from a tail of Hydra or from a tail of Boltzmann. And if you look in the code, it's from the tail of Boltzmann. So if you see Boltzmann distribution going over six orders of magnitude and say, do you believe their tail? Well, I don't have a particle argument why should I believe it. In principle, if I have molecules in this room, by the way, it was tested that it is good up to, I don't know, 10 orders of magnitude. Boltzmann, but it has infinite time to be formalized, right? Here it doesn't. But the fact of the matter is that Hydra operates up to 2-3 GeV, and the spectra correctly describe the data for baryons. So we have and jets completely fail because jets do not go into baryons and they don't have all these distributions, etc., etc. So we have two phenomena, jet quenching, that the jets of the order of 10 GeV momenta, just again repeat,
they die.
And that was not predicted by anyone. They die, really seriously die, by a quenching factor like 3, 4, 5, not 10% attenuation. And on the other hand, the other thing which also was never predicted, that you can make a collective flow and throw a baryon into 5 GeV momentum by this.
I actually looking for hands. Were there hands up which I wasn't looking for?
Yeah, but that was too much phenomenology, right? At the end.
Well, you want to get rid of everything.
But maybe I forgot to tell you once again.
Edward is here for four and a half more weeks.
Yeah, one sentence.
We don't figure out what he was talking about.
Why we are so enthusiastic that for 10 years when Rick was under construction, our PQCD friends were telling us that nothing will happen. There would be some jets coming in, and it would be simple superposition of jets, and it is the same as MPP times A, and nothing is interesting. So people who were doing that with PP extrapolation, with mini jets, etc., with a cutoff around 1.5 to GeV, find that all these phenomena, in order to reproduce anything similar to what is observed, they should increase in their cascade codes or whatever the product of number of gluons times the gluon cross section they use by roughly factor 80. Otherwise, they're out of business completely. So
this is just to say that they all predicted these.
Yes, they all predicted these things to be zero, basically, or appearing here and then decreasing and falling off. But here also zero. And
I guess I remember plots which were sort of Hydra plus cascade, which rose and then turned around.
Well, if they show cascade without Hydra, it's a little negative, and then it's just nothing like it is. It is a very robust collective explosion, which we also call the little bank. And I'm telling that this consists of small mini banks, which I'm not sure they're spherical, but I describe them as spherical, okay? Okay.